Jeremy Irons and Eileen Atkins. But first, an introduction to the poem with contributions from Dr. Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the poets Jackie Kay, Matthew Hollis and Sean O'Brien.
Well, Eliot, of course, thought initially about calling the poem He Do the Police in Different Voices, which is a thrilling and beguiling and puzzling title. And you wonder why he might have chosen a title like that. But then Eliot himself was a man of many voices and many personas. One of his peers described him as a company of actors inside one suit, and his variousness of voice and experience would suggest the title He Do the Police in Different Voices might have been quite apt. But then he raised the stakes slightly. He took a title that was, in a sense, vernacular and demotic and strange, and he gave us a poem that seemed to talk about an age rather than an experience, an age that was post-war, but was also not mended, not rebuilt, that in some sense was a desert, some sense was barren. Unfortunately, it did give the Manchester Guardian the opportunity to call it waste paper when they reviewed it rudely on its arrival. But it seems a title that is echoic, that sets the mind echoing forward, backwards, in every which way we will take it. And that's one of the strengths. It's a title that will never date, that will never seem old, that will never seem without its use and without its relevance.
When Eliot writes under this title of The Wasteland, he's pulling together, of course, a very potent mythical theme, the theme in legend, in Arthurian legend, of a whole country which is devastated by, we might say, by the collapse of authority, but in fact by the wound of the king. Authority is weak, authority has suffered, and the result is devastation. Now, Eliot is not writing this as a Christian. He's writing in his pre-conversion period. But there is behind that a sense that in some way the disappearance of the sacred as the ultimate authority, the disappearance of meaning that goes with that, is a huge wound in the individual psyche and in the experience of the society. So that's the waste, I think, inner and outer, that comes from a particular kind of loss, a particular kind of bereavement in the culture.
It's probably arguably the first great modernist poem, and it's really a great poetic counterpart to a novel published in the very same year, Ulysses by James Joyce. And I think of the two works together in a way, Ulysses and The Wasteland. So it's kind of an extraordinary poem because it melds together almost everything that's gone before in literature, and yet at the same time takes a huge big leap forward. And at the time, all of the slippages that are in the poem were difficult for people. I mean, it's an obscure poem. It's one that's difficult to grapple with. But once you get into its strange and echoey, rumbled and stony world, it kind of sucks you into it. And there you are. You're kind of buried in the rubble of it all. I think it's amazing because it combines, it's a wonderful mixture of the medieval with the modern. And it really probably is definitely the first great modernist poem, rising, you know, out of the ashes from a kind of almost earthquake zone. You get a sense that everything's been broken. Everything in literature that's come before, Shakespeare, Ovid, Sappho, it's all been broken down and brought together again by this magnificent poem. So it both looks back into the past and looks forward into the future. And in that sense, it's really quite uncanny, and it has a kind of Joycean sense of time with it. You know, you get the sense of a single day and a single moment, a bit of the agony of a particular marriage. At the same time, you get all these different voices.
Eliot begins working on the poem in 1921, the year before it's published, although he's clearly had it in mind for some time longer than that. And it comes at a time of real personal turmoil and ill health. And in fact, he's down in Margate in Kent under doctor's orders to have weeks away from London. And of course, Margate pops up in the poem when he writes on Margate Sands, "I can connect nothing with nothing." And he begins the poem there in a rock shelter that's now a Grade II listed building and a hotel there, and carries it on in Lausanne in Switzerland, where at the time he's undergoing something that we'd understand today, something pretty close to psychotherapy.
One of the very distinctive things about The Wasteland is that, of course, it's something which caught the imagination of a whole generation, a whole culture that felt things were falling apart, but did so because of the experience of one particular person who felt his life had been falling apart. And part of what I think is still its extraordinary power is that fusion of a sense of inner disintegration and a sense of cultural crisis or cultural collapse in the wake of the First World War. It's certainly not a war poem, we know that. At the same time, it captured a particular feeling that had a lot to do with that era. Now, I don't think we're any less of a collapsing or fragmented culture than we were. And for our experience of fracture somehow to be held by a powerful poetic vision, that's a very salutary, a very, very positive thing. These fragments have I shored against my ruin, says Eliot. And I think that's what a lot of people feel, that building up fragmented images and experience at a time when there's a sense of ruin or crisis, that's a sign of hope in a very strange way.
It's a great challenge to the understanding, and people sometimes find it a bit forbidding because of its range of reference, but I think its life is its power to compel the imagination, to make you wonder at things, the way in which Eliot can compile together apparently very distant points of reference. A bar in the city, Cleopatra's throne, mythical characters, the fall of various ancient cities, the sense of a civilization under collapse, and also a religious crisis undergone by somebody who is speaking in some parts of the poem and is seeking release from a sense of sin. I suppose the sense of sin is probably, in Europe at any rate, less widespread than it used to be. But the sense of personal crisis and the need for some kind of redemptive intervention is still widely persistent. So it does speak to us. It also laid down a challenge to everybody who came after to actually think about how they were writing poems rather than simply to write poems with the habits of the late 19th century. And the history of poetry in Britain since Eliot has been a series of attempts to address the challenge that Eliot and Pound and other European modernists laid down.
It's very difficult. It presents you a challenge. I mean, the poem really is a challenge of voices and silence, and it presents you with a challenge as a reader. And I remember first coming across it in school and just thinking it was just gobbledygook. It was like a nonsense poem to me, just not that much difference to Beware of the Jabberwocky. You know, it was almost the language and the way that it combined the language was kind of, it seemed a made up thing to me, and annoying initially because I couldn't find a way into it, frustrating, because it made me feel that there was something lacking in me that I couldn't find a way into it. And then just certain lines from the poem keep on ringing in your head, and you kind of almost return through those lines as if they give you a little door that you open, like a side door to a massive building, and you go in through the side door to the massive building and find all of the things that are there inside. So for me, I love the lines, you know, I will show you fear in a handful of dust. I love the very famous line, April is the cruelest month, but I also love the humour in certain lines, like, you know, what did you get married for if you don't want children?
Eliot himself said that it is just a piece of rhythmical grumbling. And of course he meant that partly about his own situation and his personal malaise, but he meant it to some degree about the malaise of society that was emerging from the breakdown of the First World War. And certainly the critics at the time responded very, very strongly to that, and it was depicted as a poem about the malaise of the era. And to some degree, it met with a very mixed response by the critics at the time. J.C. Squire, who was known as one of the leading critics of the day, but also particularly one that was perhaps in tune with the Georgian poets who had preceded this arrival of what was then known as a modernist poem, or would be. And he talked about it as consisting of borrowed jewels, that it was incomprehensible. And others said the same thing. The American poet William Carlos Williams said he thought it put poetry back 20 years because it seemed to rely on references that were escaping the reader, that relied on the European tradition of poetry, at a time where Eliot, of course still an American poet living in England, should have responsibilities to what Pound called making it new, making literature exciting, stripped to the bone, vivid. So there were many that felt that actually this was somehow against its moment. But of course, to others, it seemed exactly holy of the moment, because it drew on a canvas that was almost too big for the poem as a form. It seemed so various. It had so many competing voices, so many parts that didn't perhaps seem to glue together one to another. And what better way to try and reflect some of the experience of a country getting off its knees in the wake of the biggest disaster and apocalypse that the world had known until that point?
In a way, Eliot completely understood radio. And in The Wasteland, it's strange because you get all of these very, very different voices. You get demotic French, you get German, you get Hindi, you get ordinary speaking voices, and you get great sort of prophetic voices. He mixes together prophecy with ordinary speech. And so it's a great democratic poem, and it kind of understands the way that sound works. It's really obsessed with voices. You know, he does the police in different voices, which comes from an understanding of Dickens. But you get this kind of great appreciation of all of these different voices coming together. And in that way, it's completely perfect for the radio. But you also get an obsession with silence, too, which also makes you think of the radio, the way that silence is so important. And so it seems to me that the poem The Wasteland is all about sound and silence. It's about people who have a right to speak and people who are not allowed to speak. And it's about repression and also trying to break free from repression. And in that sense, these themes coming as they do from out of the war and into this period are completely modern and for our time, because we're still really very much preoccupied with what makes a marriage work, what makes relationships work, and what we can speak about and what we feel we have to be silent about. So it seems to me very, very pertinent to today. You know, Catherine Mansfield thought that Eliot was very, very repressed. And she said, you know, he needs gently laughing at and setting free. And it's almost as if Pound came along and took The Wasteland and helped Eliot set it free, because of course before Pound's sharp knife, The Wasteland was a very different poem altogether. So it needed Pound to give it a pounding, really. It needed the editing skills of Pound to make it the poem that we know it is today. So you've got sort of Eliot's poise and Pound's sharp knife, and the two of them together make The Wasteland. So in a sense, you've got more than one poet in that poem, and it's communal. And so I think that's also really, really interesting, that it kind of makes you think of the ways in which poets influence each other and the sense of history. So Pound comes through Yeats and into Eliot.
Ezra Pound takes the poem and he works on the pages, as does Eliot's wife, Vivian. And between them, what emerges is a apparently simpler poem, a poem that has some of the clutter taken out, more of the clarity introduced. Very little is introduced, and Vivian famously introduces the line, "What do you want to get married for if you don't want to have children?" which ends up in the final poem. And Pound's comments can be seen all over the manuscript, but what Pound is largely doing is stripping away material. And that very famous line, "April is the cruelest month," that we know is the opening of the poem, was of course not the original opening line of the poem. The original line of the poem in manuscript was, "First we had a couple of feelers down at Tom's place." But Pound didn't think much of that, and Eliot concurred, and that first page went.
Eliot was one of the first poets I ever read with any attention. As a child, I'd been given his Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats and had been absolutely fascinated by the rhythmic power of it. Fantastic, virtuosic, rhythmic writing. And when I reread the poem now, that's still the thing that really compels me. I'm interested, obviously, in meaning, but there's a certain way of organising rhythm which Eliot does endless variations on. It's a kind of cousin to the standard English iambic line, which he stretches and interrupts and turns on its head from time to time. And it also drives what Eliot at one time called the imaginative logic of a poem. It's not so much that we are concerned with thematic sense as with a certain coherence of sensation, as it has been described, a sense that we're in the presence of something of significance that we have a lifetime to ponder over. And Eliot is a poet I've never stopped reading. I continue to be fascinated by him, both by the early work, this and Proof Rock, but also by a couple of the four quartets. And what I'm really beguiled by ultimately is rhythm, the musical character of the poem.
I read The Wasteland first as a teenager, as I guess a lot of people will do, and like every teenager reading poetry, identified with the emotions that I didn't really understand or contain. But what it did, I think, was to create in me a sense of the terrible poignancy of the history of the 20th century, a poignancy which, at one extreme, is the tragedy of the collapse of civilizations, which is part of the story of the century, the poignancy of countless individual lives wrecked or distorted. And it's, in that sense, a poem which really does, I think, move to compassion. It's not, as some people say, a heartless poem at all. I think it's a profoundly compassionate poem, but in a very unsentimental way. And that's one of the reasons that I find myself still so very stirred by it.
The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. 1. The Burial of the Dead.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers.
Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled, and I was frightened. He said, Murray, hold on tight, and down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night, and go south in the winter.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water, only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind, der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du?
You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak, and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing, looking into the heart of light, the silence. Ut und lehr das mir.
Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold, nevertheless is known to be the wisest woman in Europe with a wicked pack of cards.
Here,
said she,
is your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those are pearls that were his eyes, look. Here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel. And here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I'm forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days.
Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet. Flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, "Stetson! You, who were with me in the ships at Mylee. That corpse you planted last year in your garden. Has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? Or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère."
2. A Game of Chess.
The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out. Another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branch candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it from satin cases poured in rich profusion. In vials of ivory and coloured glass, unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered or liquid, troubled, confused and drowned the sense in odours. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the laquaria, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling. Huge seawood fed with copper burned green and orange, framed by the coloured stone, in which sad light a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantel was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene, the change of Philomel by the barbarous king so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, "Jug, jug, to dirty ears." And other withered stumps of time were told upon the walls. Staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room enclosed. Footsteps shuffled on the stair. Under the firelight, under the brush, her hair, spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still.
"My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think."
"I think we're in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones."
"What is that noise?"
"The wind under the door."
"What is that noise now? What is the wind doing?"
"Nothing again. Nothing."
"Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing?"
"I remember. Those are pearls that were his eyes."
"Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head?"
"But, oh, 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 that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent."
"What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down, so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do?
The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door.
When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words, I said to her myself.
Hurry up, please, it's time.
Now Albert's coming back, make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did, I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set, he said. I swear I can't bear to look at you. And no more can't I, I said. And think of poor Albert. He's been in the army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it him, there's others will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. Then I'll know who to thank, she said, and give me a straight look.
Hurry up, please, it's time.
If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique, and her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already and nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What you get married for if you don't want children?
Hurry up, please, it's time.
Well, that Sunday Albert was home, they had a hot gammon, and they asked me in to dinner to get the beauty of it hot.
Hurry up, please, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time.
Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night. Ta-da. Good night. Good night.
Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night.
3. The Fire Sermon.
The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. By the waters of Leman I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckles spread from ear to ear. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank while I was fishing in the dull canal, on a winter evening round behind the gashouse, musing upon the king my brother's wreck, and on the king my father's death before him. White bodies naked on the low damp ground, and bones cast in a little low dry garret rattled by the rat's foot only year to year. But at my back from time to time I hear the sound of horns and motors which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash their feet in soda water. Et oh, ces voix d'enfants chantant dans le coupole.
Twit, twit, twit. Jug, jug. Jug, jug. Jug, jug. So rudely forced to rue.
Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven, with a pocket full of currants, CIF London documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits, like a taxi throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window, perilously spread her drying combinations, touched by the sun's last rays. On the divan are piled, at night, her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives, a small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired. Endeavours to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once, exploring hands encounter no defence. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all enacted on this same divan or bed. I, who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass.
Well, now, that's done, and I'm glad it's over.
When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone.
This music crept by me on the waters.
And along the Strand, up Queen Victoria Street, oh, city, city. I can sometimes hear, beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin, and a clatter and a chatter from within, where fishmen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendour of Ionian white and gold.
The river sweats oil and tar, the barges drift with the turning tide, red sails wide to leeward swing on the heavy spar. The barges wash drifting logs down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs. Wae la la, le aya, wa la la, le la la. Elizabeth and Leicester, beating oars, the stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold. The brisk swell rippled both shores, southwest wind carried downstream the peal of bells. White towers. Wai la la, le aya, walaya, le la la. Trams and dusty trees. Highbury bore me, Richmond and Kew undid me. By Richmond, I raised my knees, supine on the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Moorgate and my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent?
On Margate Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. The broken fingernails of dirty hands. My people, humble people, who expect nothing.
La la.
To Carthage then I came, burning, 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 burning. O Lord, thou pluckest me out. O Lord, thou pluckest burning.
Four. Death by water. Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls and the deep sea swell and the profit and loss. A current under sea picked his bones in whispers. As he rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. Five. What the Thunder Said.
After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. Here is no water but only rock. Rock and no water and the sandy road, the road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain mouth of carrier's teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock, if there were the sound of water only, not the cicada and dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. But there is no water.
Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman. But who is that on the other side of you?
What is that sound high in the air? Murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains? Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air. Falling towers. Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London. Unreal. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings. And bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall. And upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours. and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. In this decayed hole among the mountains in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing over the tumbled graves about the chapel. There is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. It has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree, cocorico, cocorico, in a flash of lightning. Then a damp gust bringing rain. Ganga was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himavant. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. Then spoke the thunder. Da! Da-ta! What have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. By this, and this only, we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries, or in memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Da! Dayadvam. I have heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, thinking of the key. Each confirms a prison only at nightfall. Ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Da! Damyata! The boat responded gaily to the hand, expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. I sat upon the shore, fishing, with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? London Bridge is falling down. Falling down. Falling down. Pois escose nel fuoco caena fina, quando fiam caio celidon. Oh, swallow, swallow. Le prince d'Aquitaine à la tour aboli. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. Why then I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again. Data, Dayadvam, Damyata. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot was read by Jeremy Irons and Eileen Atkins. It was directed by Susan Roberts and produced in Salford by Gary Brown. After the news, how long does it take to grow a